Robbie and Peter wanted to know what spam was. This is spam. And so, would you get your, come and get your cans of spam? I'm trying to get rid of spam today, yeah. Pass it. You want to get that, keep that in your cupboard for Y3K or whatever.
You got to love that stuff that comes from Minnesota, and that's right next to Wisconsin.
I had one written question, and that was the, last week we talked about the origin of Latin, and so I have definitive news. If I don't know if you are used to using the internet for your research, like something like google.com, where you can type in a word or a phrase or a keyword, and you'll get zillions of answers. And so if you type in origin of Latin, you'll get a whole bunch back. Latin is a relatively recent language. It goes back to only at about 600, 500, 600 B.C., didn't even come into common use until 150 B.C. And Latin was a local language in one of the provinces of Italy, and it was sort of adopted as a language. And from Latin, Latin's probably reached its great height in, like in the Catholic Church and in formal Latin. So it's not a old, old language. And, of course, our French, Spanish, Portuguese, Romanian, Italian languages came out of Latin. Well, having found that on the internet, I looked to see where Greek came from. Greek's a much, much older language. It's dates, you can trace it back to like 1500 BC, much older. And as we mentioned last week, the common language in the Roman Empire was Greek for a long period of time. So that's interesting. 12% of our words in English come from Greek origins, Greek roots. So that's what you can find on the internet. Now today we want to look at the book of Job, quickly with regard to creation. Ray Edmonds' marvelous sermons on Job used to be in this book called Beyond Suffering, which is probably not in the bookstore anymore, but it is on Ray's website, and it's a great book. There's a wonderful man, I think he's still alive, named Walter Lang. If he's still alive, he's 90-something or other, and I've known him for many years. He runs around the country on the subject of creation science, and this book is on Job and science, and he looks at all the Hebrew words all the way through the book and their relevance for science, and that's been kind of a handy reference book. But I want to look at the last chapters of Job today and their relevance for creation. And next week we'll look at what the New Testament says about creation, and then we're done. And then you can go on and do something really useful here on Sunday morning. I probably should do a little short summary of Job, just so that you, if you haven't looked at it yet. Job is probably the oldest book in the Bible. It's probably written before Moses wrote the first five books down. When we meet Job at the beginning of the book, he's 70 years old. At the end of the book, we find that he lived another 140 years, so he lived what looks like 210 years. Lifespans like that were characteristic of people who lived around the time of Abraham. Abraham lived to 175, so that'd be one good reason to think that Job lived maybe at the time of Abraham, maybe before a little bit. He lived in the land of Uz, U-Z, that's probably Jordan, probably Edom. It would be east of Israel. And it's very interesting that the scenario of the book is when we meet this man, he's called righteous and blameless and upright. He fears God and shuns evil. He's a very rich man. He has 7 sons and 3 daughters. He has 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 oxen and 500 donkeys and many servants. And he's a very wealthy rancher then, and has is also a very godly man. And you'd think that all was well with him. And one of the dilemmas of the whole book of Job is, why did God allow such a series of terrible catastrophes to come to him? Right after we're introduced to Job, the scene switches in chapter 1, verse 6, to heaven. It switches to the spiritual, unseen spiritual world around about us. And we find that there's a certain time when the angels come before the throne of God and are inquiring of God. This would be not only the good angels, but also the evil angels and also the adversary, Satan, who comes before God. Apparently, we get a little glimpse of what's going on in the, behind the scenes in the invisible realm. The discussion that goes on between God and Satan here regarding Job is initiated by God. God's the one who initiates it and asks the question of Satan, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan challenges God on this and says that if Job had some hard times and some rough going, he would deny you and curse you to your face. And so he's really not all the way good to the brutes. And God gives Satan permission to, number one, first of all, strip away everything that Job owns, his possessions. His sons and daughters are killed. His servants, the Iraqis and the Arabs, move in and raid his herbs and carry them away. So he's finally reduced to total destitution. So all of the wealth and all of the riches that he have are stripped away from him, and he's left brokenhearted. And his wife is still there. She's eventually comes around, but at first she's not particularly helpful. And Satan comes back to God again. What we find out is that God has allowed Satan to do this to Job. Satan comes back again and still asks the same question. And God gives Satan even more territory by allowing him to ruin Job's health and to strip him right down to the very core of misery and suffering and hardship, but not to destroy his life. Satan is limited from destroying Job's life. The word there for life is nephesh, soul. So that suggests that Satan might even have had the power to actually end Job's life, except for God's restraint. Well, this is interesting that, first of all, most of the time we have God's protection around us all the time, and Satan has access to us only by permission. And so you can see that everything that we have and own is there because of God's grace and kindness toward us. At the beginning of the book of Job, we have three principal characters. We have God, Job, and Satan, these three principal characters. When we get to the end of the book of Job, we have only God and Job, and Satan drops out of the whole picture. Well, there's a little clue to the fact that God has some inner work to do with Job, that this isn't suffering for no good reason, that this is redemptive suffering that's designed to bring Job into a deeper relationship with God and expose some hidden faults and flaws. And we'll see a little bit about what those are as you go through the book. So Job is reduced then to being penniless and broke and miserable and covered with boils and sitting in a pile of ashes and lamenting his fate and wishing he'd never been born. Well, probably the worst trial of all is that Job's three friends come along. These are his peers, fellow churchgoers, and they come along to comfort him. And these guys are not helpful at all. They sit there and talk to Job some nine times, and after which Job tries to answer them. Their accusations are not good. They come along and they prejudge the man already. So they say such things as, well, Job, you must have sinned. So God's brought this judgment on you because of some sins you've committed. So if you'll repent, well, obviously God will put things back in order. Helpful things like that. These three friends, however, are lacking in empathy. They don't bother to pray with Job. They've already made up their mind as to why this is happening to him, so they're not really going to be sympathetic brothers that'll help him, encourage him, stand by him. So in the long run, in the final analysis, these three friends are disqualified, and God's very unhappy with the kind of advice they've given, which is a reminder to all of us that we need to be careful how we treat one another and not look just at the circumstances of somebody's life and assume the worst is going on, because this trial has very good purpose. As we get near the end of the book, there's one young man named Elihu who has been watching all of this going on, and he's been listening to Job's friends analyze his situation and say all these cruddy things that drag him down even further. Elihu is a young man, and so he doesn't want to barge in first of all and analyze the situation. But when everybody else has spoken, he steps forward and says very plainly, and he claims that he's not speaking on his own authority, that he's studied and prayed, and he's going to speak what he thinks God wants him to say. And he essentially disqualifies these three friends from having anything to say. But then he addresses Job, and he says, well, Job, I've observed that there are some issues in your life that are now become obvious to me. And the issues that are now sort of have come to the surface about Job's life is that Job thinks that God is unjust. He accuses God of being unjust. He doesn't curse God, as Satan said he would. He doesn't deny God. Job also knows that he's righteous, and so he thinks that his actions are inherently righteous. That means there's a little bit of self-righteousness in him. He also doesn't quite see that God's a very personal God, so he has a kind of an impersonal, remote God. He's a devout man. He's very godly. He offers sacrifices not only for himself but for his sons every year on their birthday, just to cover all the bases. So he's God-fearing. And blameless means that he's kept a close accounts with God all his life. But that doesn't mean there aren't inner flaws that have to come to the surface. Well, Elihu sort of lays bare those inner flaws, and that helps us to see that there's purpose in this suffering and these trials, and that God has something to bring out of this. And sure enough, at the end of the story, at the very end of the story, God forgives Job totally, cleanses him completely, gives him back seven more sons and three more daughters. So he has seven sons and three daughters in heaven, and seven more and three on earth, and gives him back all of his possessions all over again times two. So he ends up greatly blessed at the end of his life, and has only lived a third of his life. So the last years are better than the first, and these inner flaws. In the course of all of this trouble, Job does discover that there's a mediator. He does come into a more personal, intimate relationship with God. He does see his own pride and self-righteousness. So this is a marvelous, marvelous book. Now, I've given you my opinions, which are Stedman opinions, I hope. Otherwise, I could be wrong. And so if this intrigues you, read the book of Job and then see what if Ray doesn't help you a little bit. Now, chapter 37 is about the point that Elihu stops talking. And there's a big electric storm going on in there. But 38 is from chapter 38, which is where we start. We come through. Job's been all through this misery and all this stuff. Now, this is a very wise man. He's a godly man. He's lived much closer to creation than any of us. And he maybe had much more direct knowledge passed on down to him about the creation. And he may well have been following the Lord for many, many years. So you'd expect that he'd have a great deal of wisdom and insight into nature and God and creation and need to understand things. And now, having been said and done, now God decides to speak to him directly in a whirlwind and ask him a whole bunch of questions. Now, put yourself in his shoes here and imagine what would happen if God called you into his presence and said, "Oh, by the way, I have a little quiz for you today. I have some questions, and if you would, please, would you answer these questions?" And there's a series of questions, and God begins with a question of questions about creation. And this is eloquent Hebrew poetry. I wish I could read Hebrew, because I expect that the language is very, very beautiful and colorful. "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?'" Whoops. "Prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. Stand up and be like a man, and we'll have a little God-man discussion here, and I'm just going to ask you a few questions about what you know about things. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know." There was a time when the architect of the universe was designing the universe and laying out maps and surveying it and planning it. And so God asked Job, "By the way, I don't remember that you were there when we had the committee meeting and planned the universe. Why don't you recap a little bit about what you know about the design behind the universe?" First question. "And the measurements and all of the physical laws that are going to come into place. Let's talk a little bit about that." Look at the satire in all this. "Who stretched out the line upon it?" Who measured it? What surveyors went out and measured this empty space and determined the overall dimensions of it? "Surely you know. To what were its foundations fastened? Who laid its cornerstone?" That's kind of interesting language, that the earth should be thought of having big foundations under it and having a cornerstone. Very nice poetic imagery. we're not here talking only about the physical universe. We're also talking about the unseen universe. And so God wants to probe a little bit beyond just the visible realm. And in verse 7, he brings up the angels. Where were you when we measured out the universe, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Now, here seems to be a close connection between the stars and the angels. Remember the term sons of God, which we had back in Genesis 6? The Benoi Elohim, the sons of God, the angels. So this is a verse that strongly suggests, I don't think it's 100% true, strongly suggests that the angels were observers watching God create the universe. And they stood back and watched all of this. They must have been then created very early on, and they get to observe the creation, and they worship and take delight in watching this all unfold. They get the grandstand seat. Yeah. Yes. Yes. There is some. Lang talks about that. Setterfield talks about this too. About the sounds the stars make, the vibrations that come out of the stars. The morning star also has a picture later on of Jesus, the bright and morning star is Jesus. So there's a parallel here between the angels and the stars. That goes all the way through the Bible. We kind of saw that way back in Genesis, okay? Well, the idea here is that, Job, you weren't there when I created the universe, but a bunch of angels were, a whole bunch of angels, and they could tell you a lot more already about it than you already know. Verse 8, who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. When the earth was made as this rotating sphere. If you see a satellite picture of the earth, you notice how, or from space, you notice that half of the earth is always in darkness and it's clothed in clouds. And God did all that. When I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors for the ocean. And when I said, this far you may come, but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. That's also in Psalm 104, which we looked at last week, that there are boundaries for the oceans and the continents. And God has set those and keeps the oceans in their basins. Verse 12. Next question. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? Oh, Job, by the way, we probably ought to have some sunshine here on the earth. Let's have sunrise and sunset. And let's have seasons. And were you the one that put all this into place? And just look at the dawn. Every day the sun comes up and the lights all change across the day. And then the sun moves up to mid-sky and we have heat and we have seasons. Did you do all this, by the way? Did you think this out and put it into a place? From the standpoint of an observer on earth, it seems to be all just happening all the time. And he says regarding the sun, that it may take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. The sun's this great light, and darkness is associated with evil, and Jesus is the sun, S-U-N, of righteousness. And it's his job to banish evil, and one of the ways God banishes evil is to shine his light into the dark corners. It takes on form like clay under a seal and stands out like a garment. The earth is lightened by the sun. When the sun comes up, you begin to see the hills and the valleys and the shadows all flee away. So you begin to see the earth as it really is. From the wicked, their light is withheld and the upraised arm is broken. So there's a picture here of moral light and darkness and physical light and darkness that we talked a little bit back in Genesis 1. Oh, by the way, Job, have you entered the springs of the sea, the fountains of the deep? Now, you know, just in the last few years, we found these great hot springs in the very deepest parts of the oceans that are spewing up very hot water out of the interior of the earth, mineral-laden water. And, Job, how's your oceanography? How about the interior of the earth? What do you know about the interior of the earth and all the things I put down there? Men build mines. Earlier in Job talks about mining and how men learn how to go down into the earth to get minerals. But how far do we go down into the earth? Well, we go down into the earth 5,000 feet, maybe a little more. Hardly into the crust at all. We drill an oil well, the deepest oil well is maybe, 30, 35,000 feet? That's nothing. What about the interior of the earth? Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths. Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Oh, yeah, there's another set of mysteries. Job, surely you know all about this. I'm sure you've been in and out through the doors of death, and you know what lies on the other side. And why don't you tell me all about that? You probably know that the Tibetan religion has a book, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The Egyptians, later Egyptian pyramids were decorated with the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the mythologies of what happens to the Pharaoh when he dies and goes into the underworld and meets all the gods and is judged and goes under the Nile River and is reborn the next morning as the sun god. And all that mythology and all that folklore. Then we have the Greek and the Roman mythologies about Hades and what happens after death. Those are just mythologies. And here, so God says, I don't want these mythologies. Please tell me all about this from your based on your own knowledge. And your own mortality, of course, is in here too. So what do you know about life and death at their roots? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? How's your geography? World at this time being unexplored, I'm sure that he hadn't been on American Airlines or Pandemonium World Squareways or anything like that, and he hadn't seen things, so he hadn't been to Fiji and Samoa and Tahiti. And yet God gives him his geography lesson. Says, oh, well, let's talk about the continents and the exotic places to travel. Tell me if you know all this. Everybody's going to flunk this class, you see here, and we're all going to flunk out with this kind of a cross-exam. And I think that's what God's after. Oh, by the way, where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place? What are the unseen origins of light? Not just the photons of the visible world, but the light that is God himself and the light that is in the invisible world and the light that's in the angels. What about, tell us all about these things, the store cabinets. Where is the dwelling, the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home? Roots and origins. Do you know it because you were born then? Were you there? How old are you, Job? Oh, only 70. Oh, well, how much have you learned in 70 years? Well, how old am I, God says? How long do you think I've been here? Well, it sort of reduces Job pretty quick here. Now let's talk about ice and snow. Now, there wouldn't have probably been ice and snow in Jordan, in the land of Jordan or in the land of Uz at this time, unless, of course, the earth was recovering from its last ice age. But it doesn't matter because God knows all about the polar regions and about glaciers and so on. And so now God wants a little meteorology out of Job. He's such a Bindala University, so he knows weather prediction. And have you entered the treasury of snow? Have you seen the treasury of hail, which I reserve for the time of trouble? Remember the great battles in the Bible when God uses hailstones from heaven and will in the book of Revelation again? So God has these weapon caches up in the sky that are hailstones that he can throw down on people if he wants to. By what way is light diffused or the east wind scattered over the earth? Who controls storms and events in nature? Verse 25, who has divided a channel for the overflowing water or a path for the thunderbolt to cause it to rain in a land where there was no one? Empty wilderness. Sometimes you'll get a wonderful rainfall out in the middle of nowhere where there's nothing at all but desert, and God grows some green flowers for his own enjoyment and there's no people around. So, Job, do you understand these things? But God does. He wants to satisfy the desolate waste and cause to spring forth the growth of tender grass. Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? We know a little bit about rain now. We know that rain condenses around small particles in the atmosphere. And in order to try to make it rain, a lot of cloud seeding is done with iodide particles, as you probably know. But still, how and when and where it rains is something that's not in our control. We have a hard time just guessing where it's going to rain. And, of course, the earth is very much dependent on rainfall. From whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven? Now, there's hail and snow and ice and frozen things here. The water is hardened like stone and the surface of the deep is frozen. God could freeze a whole ocean and make great glaciers. Oh, can you do this, Job? How are you about this? Engineering nature. All right, well, that's enough. We'll stop talking about the Earth. Let's go talk about the constellations next. Let's have a little quiz on your freshman astronomy section. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades? That's the constellation which we now call the Seven Sisters. It's very beautiful in the sky. You can find it. Can you loose the belt of Orion? Orion's the big winter constellation that's prominent in December with the three bright stars in the belt. Can you bring out the Maseroth in its season? Word on origin, meaning not very well known. Can you guide the Great Bear? That's the Big Dipper with its cubs. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Well, this kind of suggests a primitive Hebrew astrology, that there was originally a gospel in the stars. Seiss and Bollinger have two books that are still in print called having to do with the gospel in the stars. But originally, the constellations may have been a map to lay out the plan of redemption. Yeah. 70. Oh, the book. Well, anybody have a comment on that? Well, obviously, the Hebrew translators have put modern terms on these, but that comes down through this long historical record. So this suggests that Job knew the constellations and the Hebrews had name for them. This is the argument in Bollinger's and Seiss's great books, that the constellations were known. The Arabs were very good at navigation and used the stars for navigation. When Abraham went out on a night sky to take care of his flocks, where there were no city lights, you see the splendor of all the heavens at night. And the constellations were evidently named very, very early on. From Genesis 1 on the fourth day, remember that the sun, the moon, and the stars, the constellations were to mark out signs and seasons. Seasons to mark out the festivals, the 12 seasons of the Hebrew calendar. The astrology that we have now is Babylonian, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago. It's thoroughly corrupt, and it's thoroughly pagan. And all it's suggested here is that there once was a map of the heavens that God laid out so that people would have what's called the gospel in the stars. Now I have a long article on my website on this whole thing. It's a little controversial. But just look at the language here. There seems to be a description of the constellations way back then. This could have been 4,000 years ago. And once again, remember the fourth day of creation. The sun and moon, the sun to rule the day, the moon to rule the night, and the stars also were made to mark out seasons. And so the progression of the stars across the heavens over the course of the year is the way the ancients could mark out their year, length of year. Okay? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Having a dry spell, why don't you go out and pray and have it rain today, Job? We could use a little extra rain. Why don't you just go out? Let's just make a little rain, if you would. Shouldn't be too hard for you. Can you send out lightnings that they may go? How about some big lightning displays just to entertain us here? I think of Nikola Tesla, the man who invented alternating current around the 1900, and built these big lightning generators. I used to build them, and they make, you know, 10, 20-foot spark some across the room. Well, how about you, Job? Can you make a big lightning flash all the way across the sky? Should be no big deal for you. Can't you do that? No. We don't even know what electricity is. Who has put wisdom in the mind? Verse 36. Who has given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Who can pour out the bottles of heaven when the dust hardens in clumps and the clods cling together? There's a little suggestion here that if you're going to manage the universe, you've got to keep track of a lot of detail. There's an awful lot of information that goes in your data bank that you want to be managing if you're going to be the creator of the universe and the one that's running the universe. God, then, we already can see that God obviously is very involved in everything that's going on in the natural world, everywhere. There's some reassurance here. Now we're going to switch over. Now we've had the astronomy and the meteorology and the cosmology and the constellations. Now let's have a little quiz, Job, on the animal life and creation. And he picks here a lion, a raven, mountain goats, deer, wild donkey, wild ox, ostrich, horse, hawk, and eagle. And he quizzes Job about these animals and how could Job take over their management. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lurk in their lairs till I wait? Job, if you want to be God, I have some assignments for you. You're going to have to go feed those lions out in the middle of the jungle. I've been feeding them every day. I take care of their cubs. And how about the raven? The raven flies all over the place, but it raises its young every year. And who provides food for the raven when its young ones cry to God and wonder about for lack of food? Does God hear the cry of the baby birds in the nest and does he feed them? Well, yes, he does, evidently. Can you do that, Job? How are you at getting along with nature? Not just the domestic animals, your cat or your dog or your parrot, but how about all the wild animals? Do you know the time, and we're going to do some obstetrics here, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they bear young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring, their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they depart and do not return to them. So how would you be able to manage the mountain goats? Leaping and prancing up over the hills that men can hardly even climb, and yet God manages for them to reproduce and raise their young, and the young grow up and become mountain goats, and it goes on and on, century after century, and maybe you've never even seen a mountain goat. How about wild donkeys? Not domestic donkeys, but a donkey called the onaker here, which is a wild donkey that doesn't like to live around people. Who set the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the onager, whose home I have made the wilderness and barren land his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city. He doesn't like to live around people, around cities. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. So here's this wild goats, wild donkeys up in the hill, and God made them for his own enjoyment, and they don't have much to do with us and go live out their lives, and God's the one that's taking care of them. How about the wild ox? Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Yeah, short of labor around the house, why don't you go out and get one of these wild oxes and just give it a few instructions and it can help you out? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to the threshing floor? Just give this wild ox some instructions, and it'll help you out. It'll go plow your fields for you, and it'll harvest your fields, and you'll have a wonderful domestic servant and ease your labor, Job. Well, obviously, that's very humorous, isn't that ridiculous? Now we're going to get, there's a lot of humor in here. We're going to get the ostrich. Why did God make such a crazy thing as an ostrich? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly. Her wings and her pinions are like the kindly storks. She leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern because God deprived her of wisdom. And he did not endow her with understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she scorns the rider and the horse and its rider. So you look at this. And God says, I made that ostrich, and I like her that way. And she says, yes, it's a real unusual bird. Now, actually, ostriches survive. They may get up and walk away from their eggs, and it may be that some of their eggs are vulnerable to other animals, but the eggs hatch, and other ostriches grow up, and ostriches aren't extinct. So God's taking care of ostriches, even if they are kind of dumb. So how about, could you do that sort of thing, Job? How about the horse? Now we're going to talk about wonderful, great horses here. Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the glittering spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he stand firm because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting. Poetry about great, strong war horses and how useful they've been in human history. How about hawks? If you go up on the hills above, towards the ocean and look out over there, you'll see hawks almost every day. And if you go elsewhere in the mountains, you'll see eagles and great birds of prey circling in the sky. Does the hawk fly by your wisdom? You teach him how to catch the air currents and circle endlessly and give him such eyesight that he can see a small moving animal on the ground? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? Can you manage eagles? They like to make their nests up on very steep cliffs. It dwells on the rock and resides on the crag of the rock and the stronghold, and there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is. Knows how to find exactly where to go get the prey. Is that your doing? Well, this is enough for Job at this point. He wants to go hide at this point. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, finally, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. If you don't like the way I'm running the universe, let's trade places. Why don't you take over a while and see how you would do? Now, this strikes, really, I think, at the heart of the fundamental lie that was in the Garden of Eden. Remember the lie in the Garden of Eden that you could all be gods? That you could be like God? And look how ridiculous that now is, just in the light of this handful of questions. And so God now directly speaks to Job and challenges those assumptions. Job's pretty well humbled at this point. He says, Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, I will not answer. Twice, but I'll proceed no further. Whoops, I take back all those things I've been saying about you and about the universe and all the things I thought I knew. I realize I probably misspoke. Well, that isn't all. God doesn't stop there. We get round two now. Now, this round two is going to go not only into nature, it's going to go into moral issues. The moral issues of running the universe. Verse 6, the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, now, prepare yourself like a man. I'll question you, and you will answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Whoops. Would you claim that God was wrong in order to prove yourself right? Do you have an arm like God, or can you thunder with a voice like his? So you're in favor of world peace, are you? You'd like to bring peace on earth? Well, what's your plan? Why don't you get your military strength and go do that? I'd be very happy if you could solve that problem of how to get human beings to get along better with them. So if you're so moral and just and right, I'll let you fix things. Adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Go out and find all the proud people and humble them. Look on everyone who is proud. Bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. If you can do that, Job, if you can do those little minor chores in the world, I will confess to you that your own right hand can save you. Can you handle that? Whoops. Have a hard problem managing the spear of our own lives, obviously, here. So let's trade places. God says, do you want my job that I have of running a world of 6 billion anarchists and managing these things? Now we're going to get descriptions of two big animals, a behemoth and leviathan. I expect these were, in early days, literal animals, probably now extinct, maybe. That's the obvious, the surface meaning, but there's a deeper meaning behind these two animals. Ray Steadman comments on this at great length, that these two animals are symbols of the pride in the world, the evil in the world. Let's see how that comes out. How God has to deal with human pride and evil. Look now at behemoth. Behemoth, that's a plural in Hebrew, by the way. It's a plural word. and this is some kind of a great land animal or land animals, I made along with you, I made this great big animal behemoth on the sixth day of creation when I made Adam. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar, like a big cedar tree. Imagine this creature like a dragon or something that moves his tails like a big cedar tree. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. Imagine bronze bones. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Only God can manage this guy. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. So God's feeding him, taking care of him. The most frightening things, I guess, in the world today are those Komodo dragons that are down in the island in Indonesia that run 12 feet long, that are scary, but they're not nearly as scary as this big creature here, this big dragon, whatever he is. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade, the willows by the brooks around him. The river may rage, but he's not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. So he's not the least bit antagonized by floods and minor inconveniences or annoyances. So this is just an incredibly great, powerful animal that God has made. Now we get to the Leviathan. Leviathan's the sea dragon, the sea monster, sea serpent. And of course, down through history, we have legends and folklore about fire-breathing dragons and about great sea serpents in the sea. We have those. And if a lot of species have gone extinct, I think we have to allow for the possibility that there may have been great creatures like this. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Put your fishing rod out here in the ocean and let's reel in one of these Leviathans. Will he make supplications to you? Is he going to come to you and ask for mercy when you start reeling him in on your little trout reel? Will he speak softly to you? Is this monster going to come in and try to persuade you to be nice to him? I don't think so. Will he make a covenant with you? He does have a relationship with God, this big Leviathan, in the sense that God feeds him, takes care of him. Will you play with him as a bird, as if he was your pet bird? Will you leash him for your maidens, as if this was a little house lizard that you could keep around as a pet? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Catch him, and maybe you could make a big dinner out of him, if you could catch him. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? No, his armor's too much to penetrate. Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. You'll never do that again if you want to tangle with this guy. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is vain. Shall not one be overwhelmed at the very sight of him? This guy is so frightening that you won't even want to get near him. No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? If you're intimidated and can't stand up against this creature from the ocean that I made, then what about me? How much greater am I, God says. You want to take me on? You want me as your adversary? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Where were you when I created the world, Job? Were you there around before me that I owe you anything? Everything under heaven is mine. There's God and his sovereignty and his majesty and his the owner of everything. He owns it all. And he controls it all and he runs it all, everything. Not just the world of man, but the world of nature is under his full care and management. I will not conceal his limbs, back to Leviathan, his mighty power or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? Pry his mouth open like a great crocodile or an alligator. His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. His scales are so overlapped, one is so near another that no air can come between them. This overlapping scales on his outward skin. His sneezings flash forth light, When he sneezes, you get flashes of light. Out of his mouth go burning lights, so evidently that he can breathe fire if he wants to, though he lives in the water. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals. A flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck. Sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. So he's muscular and armor-plated. And his heart is hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail. Swords can't pierce his armor. Nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds, chunks of broken pottery. He makes the seal boil like a pot. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. Loch Ness Monster times 100. One would think the deep had white hair because of the froth of the wake as he swims. On earth there's nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is the king over all the children of pride. Now, there's the allegory that takes us over into seeing the evil in the world and how powerful and strong it is, particularly the evil that's associated with pride and arrogance. That who can handle these invisible, unseen forces in the world, the forces of darkness and evil? Who can? Well, this is where the discussion ends. That's all. Okay, it's the end of exam time, Job. Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do everything. That no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge?" So he's just repeating God's question that God asked him. "Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you and you will answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear," Job says. "But now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes." So there's the breakthrough in which Job now realizes that he's seen God in his heart. He has this inner awareness that we all get that means that his own pride and his own self-righteousness has been broken, and he's reduced to a sense of awe and wonder and contriteness. Good place to be. Now, I was thinking about this book. I was thinking about just the whole story. And here's a godly man who's blameless, who's had a long lifetime of knowing the Lord. And he probably knows a great deal about the Lord, probably even more than we ever could. He's probably well informed on all these subjects in comparison with what little we know right now today. And yet, look at in the end where this story ends. He ends up saying, "I really don't know very much at all." Now, I think I take that contrast and compare it with the arrogance one sees in the world of science and the secular world around about us, where in the last 100 years, science has become a god to many people. And many people live with the illusion that science has unraveled or is capable of unraveling all the mysteries of life. And look at how utterly naive that is. Even the godly have only a glimpse. Even the godly have only a dim understanding of things. So how could the secular man even come close to understanding God and God's work behind the scenes? So that's where this book ends, and it ends with Job getting blessed 100 times more and being restored and having a long, full life and being in a better place than he was before. And obviously in Job's life, there's been some hidden pride and self-righteousness, and that's all been dealt with through these series of events. And then in God's questioning, he can't answer any of this. Well, where do you come? What's the end of all this? Well, the end is you come back to worship of God, and you come back to standing in awe of Him, standing of him in nature and in the universe, in the physical world, in awe of His workings in your own life, in awe of His ability to manage evil, that God is always just, He always is righteous, that everything He does is just and righteous. There's no reason to accuse Him of being unjust and unfair. No reason to lose confidence in His ability to resolve all human problems. This is the Creator of the universe. He created it not just for you and me, but for His own enjoyment. He owns it all. He understands it all. He manages it all. He's very happy to share it with you and me. But how little we know. So now, after going through all of Genesis, where we all thought we figured it all out and we had it all down right, this is a good place to come to, where we have to go back and say, well, we really don't know all that much at all. Hopefully, because of our relationship with Jesus, we have some better insights than a lot of the secular world around about us. And we do not have to be intimidated by the knowledge of a secular world, which hates God and ignores God. So that's Job. Do you have some thoughts on this? Questions? Applications? Well, that's mostly in cosmology and astronomy, or in Einstein, to come up with a unified cosmological model where all the laws of physics all hold together. Scientific naturalism, though, does assume that the world, that there is no spiritual dimension, that everything can be explained in physical terms, that we may not have all the answers, but we can get them, and all the answers will be naturalistic. There is no need for God at all. We already know, or we can know, all on our own, just on the basis of the physical world. So there's an enormous amount of arrogance in that whole thing. Look at what God's dealing here with the righteous man. Reminds me of the verse in Peter where it says, if the righteous man is scarcely saved, where will the sinner and godly appear? If we just squeak in through the door, what about the people that don't know God at all? Where will the sinner and ungodly appear? Yes? Yeah. Yeah, and we know there's no God. Yeah. Would the non-Christian be turned off by reading Job? I think in many cases, yes, probably. Job starts out to deal with the issue of suffering. Why do very terrible, bad things happen to really good people? And obviously, it isn't whimsical on the part of God that He allowed all this suffering in Job's life. It was for some purpose. If you go through a hard time in your life, if you get cancer or you get sick or something bad happens to you, you still can understand that God is going to bring good out of that. This is great comfort in this book.
And if you go through, he says, you are not a man that you can identify. You know, all these big phrases, I know that my redeemer is.
Yep.
So if you can get through it, it's quite dense, but there's incredible
answers. Yes, in the course of all this, Job, one by one, discovers the things, as you say, that are really New Testament. He finds that there is a mediator. He believes that he will be resurrected. He sees that God is a personal, intimate God. He didn't have that at the beginning. By the end of the book, he has those. And then the devil has nothing more to say to him. The devil's all gone, and it's God and Job. So this book is a great, great book. Yes, sir. And it's nice to see that God is can be logical, and he can be exact, and he pays attention to detail, and this has all of the thoroughness that a courtroom scene would have. And you're not going to get an arbitrary judgment from the judge and jury. You're going to get a fair hearing. When you come to the judgment of the great white throne in Revelation, the judgment of the wicked dead, all the books are open. Okay, God is capable of laying out every detail in our lives, and if you want to go point by point, he's got records. So there's nothing with the Muslim God. Allah is whimsical. He sort of decides who to forgive and who not to forgive arbitrarily, and there's nothing at all about exacting judgment and justice in Allah, but there certainly is in Jehovah.
Well, certainly this is the mother of shock and awe. I'm more interested in the end, because I think there's some kind of a methodology there.
Mm-hmm.
Lord talks to the three dudes that
Yeah, they get all corrected.
And then, now, certain things have to happen.
Yes. You know? Tell us a little bit. Yes, I did, but why don't you tell us?
Well, it seems that the priest had to go and make some sacrifices.
Yeah, they're all wrong, and they got to go make amends and get an apology. Yeah, and offer sacrifices to Job.
And then in verse 4, this and that.
Yeah.
And the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed.
Yeah. Yeah. He had to pray for his three friends and ask forgiveness and forgive them. And then his wife comes around in the course of the story. She's earlier skeptical. She comes around to be supportive.
It's also very interesting that none of the questions that the Lord asked Job are answered.
They're not. Yes, isn't that right? How to live in a universe with a lot of unanswered questions? How to enjoy God and not have all the answers? A peculiarity of our Greek Western civilization that we want all of detailed answers to things. We're so analytical. And I guess, yeah, probably, yeah, Aristotle, maybe so. Yeah, I think so. Sure, because his lack of the remote nature of his relationship with God, the lack of a close, personal, intimate relationship with God at the beginning of the book, would certainly have affected his relationship, his intimacy with his children and his family. And when that got corrected, obviously, the relationships all get better. Yeah, so that's interesting how the story all comes around to that, to relationships, better relationships, quality. Other thoughts on this book? Humility and contriteness and modesty. And it takes a whole lifetime for us to get these kinds of things predictable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing about this book is, how come God doesn't pull a rug out from any one of us totally and reduce us to the misery that Job had, which we wouldn't like, but... Well, and this, of course, is the number one problem with these three friends, is they are just ready immediately to judge and analyze and dissect what they think is wrong with Job, and they're wrong.